You're listening to the Journey On podcast with Warwick Schiller. Warwick is a horseman, trainer, international clinician, and author who helps empower horse people from all over the world with the skills, knowledge, and mindsets needed to create trusting partnerships with their horses. Warwick offers a free 7-day trial to his comprehensive online video library that includes hundreds of full-length training videos and several home study courses at videos.warwickschiller.com. Just because you see
what it shows. G'day everyone, welcome back to the Journey On podcast. I'm your host Warwick Schiller and my special guest this week is Holly Wilderthorne. So Holly lives in Australia and she's a psychotherapist, a clinical counsellor and a coach with a background in natural and ancestral health. So if you're still with me after that, you think, yeah, she sounds pretty cool. The next line of her bio says, witchcraft and magic, altered states and sacred space, martial arts, natural movement, women's mysteries and conscious wild living. Like all my other guests, in this episode, I try to unravel how Holly got to be into the things she's into and the journey that led her doing the things she's doing. And I got to tell you that Holly had some ancient wisdom there that I was just so glad I got to hear. So I hope you guys enjoy this conversation with Holly as much as I did. Holly Wilderthorne, welcome to the Journey On podcast.
Thanks, Warwick.
I'm excited about this. You know, someone asked me when I was recently on the Gaucho Derby, someone said, what's your podcast about? And I said, well, I interview people who the way they currently view the world is not the way that we are societally and socially brought up to view the world. And I said, my podcast is basically unraveling how they got to that point. And you sent me your bio the other day and it says, Holly has a mostly respectful disregard for the status quo and mainstream culture. And I'm like, oh, that's bloody cool. I love that. but you have this in your bio, you have this list of things that it says Holly is a, and has this list of things. What I want to do before we even start is go through these things one at a time and tell us exactly what they are.
Okay.
Because I think until people get a real idea of where you are at and the way you view the world, we don't really want to hear the story and how you got there yet. So Holly is a psychotherapist. I think we all get that. Okay. What do you have a specialty in psychotherapy?
Well, I mean, I kind of advertise to women, I guess, for anxiety and trauma. But I do also okay. work with young people just because I'm in a rural area. So I kind of take okay, what perfect. Comes. Yeah.
Okay. So Holly's a psychotherapist, clinical counselor and coach. Get that. Okay. Now we're getting interesting. With a background in natural and ancestral health, what is natural and ancestral health?
Well, by ancestral health, I mean the kind of things that humans did forever to be well. So like living outside, being barefoot, being in the sunshine, eating normal food that isn't from a supermarket, you know, those kind of things. And then natural, you know, herbalism, homeopathy, flower essences, that sort of stuff.
Okay. Well, that's not that strange. If you've listened to much of the podcast, you know, I've got a huge interest in our hunter-gatherer roots and what we no longer do that we evolved to do for a long time, and that's part of our problem. Okay,
the next thing. Exactly that.
A psychotherapist, clinical counselor, coach with a background in natural ancestral health. We've got that. The next two, witchcraft and magic. Magic with a K. So tell me about witchcraft before you get into magic.
Well, they're very closely related. Witchcraft, I mean, for me, witchcraft is about folk magic. So it's kind of leans into that natural health stuff around working with herbs, working with nature, having a relationship with the divine through nature, being kind of conscious of the outside world, but also the realities that are in the outside world. So, I guess spiritual realities or I don't know what other words people would use. I also think that witchcraft is also about some sort of act of rebellion because witches have always been the rebels, the people that push the edges, live on the boundaries, move between that edge space.
I want to challenge you on that.
Okay.
Do you think witches have always been the people who lived on the boundaries, or when, like, organized religion came along, then they were on the boundaries?
I think that.
Or do you think they've always been on the boundaries?
Yeah, I think that witches, like from a European sense at least, because I think there are different ways to speak about witches across the world. And we know that in some countries right now, it's still illegal to be a witch, and it, you know, it has a very, it has associations with demons or things like that. I'm sort of not thinking about that. I'm thinking about European heritage, and that I do think that the witchy people have always lived on the boundaries of, say, between the village and the wildness, right? So they're kind of holders of that space between, and they would interact with the villagers, but they would also interact with the wildness, and they're almost like a go-between, like a way for the villagers to enter the forest and the way for the forest to enter the village. So they hold that space.
Mm, I love that. Way for the forest to enter the village. That's awesome. And what about magic with a K? Because most people know of magic with a C. That's the magic, you know, we are socially and societally introduced to. But what about magic with a K?
Yeah, magic with a K is partly, I use that term because it differentiates from where we pull rabbits out of hats. Yeah. And so meaning the magic that comes out of nature, the things that we don't see in the world, the way that we can, you know, work in kinship with nature to create whatever reality we want, and also to work like with ourselves and each other to create realities. So it's all about sort of working between those spaces like the witch does.
Right. Yeah, that's super cool. Okay, next part. So we've got Holly's a psychotherapist, clinical counselor and coach with a background in natural and ancestral health. We understand that. Witchcraft and magic, we understand that. Altered states and sacred space, martial arts, natural movement, women's mysteries and conscious wild living. Let's go with altered states and sacred space. And I would say that most listeners to this podcast would not. This is not a stretch of the imagination, the altered states part.
Yeah, so I have a certificate in psychedelic-assisted therapies, but also before that I pretty much just worked in the space of not psychedelic but altered states, so things like holotropic breath work, meditation. I actually think exercise can be an altered state, you know, shamanic kind of styles of music and percussion, so drumming, rattling, those sorts of things. So all these ways that humans have always taken our brain out of like this really current matter-based reality into the other worlds. Does that make sense?
You know, it was interesting, when you're talking about altered states there, and before we got on here, we were just talking about the podcast I released last week or a few days ago about my adventures on the Gaucho Derby, and I had quite an experience there. But there was a lady on the Gaucho Derby there from England, and she said to me, she said something like, "Oh, that wasn't long enough. You need to walk a long way." You know, you just said about physical activity can bring on altered states. She said, "You need to walk a long. 10 days is not long enough." She said, "You need to walk a long way." And I have heard, if you wanna, what is the saying? If you want to get to know, what is it? What is that saying? If you want to get to know yourself, run a marathon. If you want to get to know God, run 100 miles or something like that. But it's about, you know, altered states from sustained physical activity. What about martial arts? What martial arts are you into?
So I started martial arts when I was 3. I did karate. And then I did taekwondo, so black belts in each. And then I had a little break in my adult life. And then later in my adult life, I started getting into natural movement through MoveNat, which is a particular system of natural movement, but there's plenty of different systems out there now. And so then just locally, people were asking me to kind of teach things. So now I have a little martial arts and natural movement school called Motion Ninja Academy, it's called. And so we combine the two. We combine all those natural movements that are like the things that humans have always done, the crawling, the climbing, jumping, and then with the combat style of martial arts as well. So all stand-up martial arts. I've never done anything on the ground. I'm quite freaked by that, honestly. And also, I don't know how to do BJJ with my hair, and no BJJs can tell me how I could do BJJ. So that has always been a barrier.
So what Holly's referring to is she has dreadlocks, so I'm not sure he'd roll around the ground with the dreads.
Exactly.
And so the last part of this short paragraph that has all of your qualifications listed in it is women's mysteries and conscious wild living. Let's start with the women's mysteries. What's that about?
Yeah, the mysteries are like the phases of life that we go through that take us to the next level of ourselves. So birth would be the first one. But then, you know, we have these sort of rites of passage along the way. So that's kind of what I refer to within the mysteries. And they're kind of thresholds that we work ourselves through. So for women, like one of those thresholds would be first menstruation. It might be birth. It might be it could be a birthday. It could be a divorce. Like there's all these different passages that we go through. But so for me, a lot of my work has always focused around like how women do that and what are the barriers for women specifically in our culture, and then working through those two, because it's not just about the birth or the bleeding phase or whatever. It's like it's the societal things around us that affect the way that we cross those thresholds, right?
Then I imagine quite a few of the people you help would be the big menopause phase too.
Yeah, well, I mean, I haven't reached that phase yet, so I've sort of been working more in the younger phase, but that's definitely where I'm heading, and I certainly see more and more women around me in that phase now. So it's kind of like we're all exploring that next one. Yeah.
Yeah, so, my wife's been through the whole thing, and, you know, there's a lot to it. There's a lot of change that happens, so I can see why people would need some guidance through that.
Absolutely, yeah.
And then the last one is I love the sound of this because, you know, I'm all over the hunter-gatherer thing, conscious wild living. Tell me about that.
Well, that probably picks up everything we just talked about, I guess. But, yeah, I do, like I'm sure we'll talk about, I run retreats and things on land, and so it's about trying to get people to come back to themselves but through nature and through finding that wildness. And, you know, I really – I'll often use words like, you know, we're domesticated people, which of course comes from, you know, other ideas, but this idea that we can rewild ourselves into who we're really here to be, not who society made us. Yeah. So that's kind of what that piece is about.
I think there's probably two parts of that, isn't there? There's the way we live that we didn't evolve to live. You know, there's that one part. But then there's the other part of all the cultural conditioning of yourself, and you don't actually know who you are. You're just a series of stories you've told yourself about yourself, or you've been told about yourself. And when you peel those away, underneath is a completely different human than you were going to be anyway, even if you are still living the way we live. But if you put those two together and like unravel yourself and then unravel how we're supposed to live, I think that's when you get to the good stuff.
Yeah. And that's the consciousness, right? I think we kind of get acculturated to be not conscious, but then as you start, like you said, you peel back those layers, you get more and more conscious. And then when you see it, you can't unsee it. So then how do I live now that I see these things? And so that's a lot of my work is like integrating people back into the world, because we can't just be monks that live on top of a hill. We're still in a world where all those things still exist. So how do you move through life with what you've seen, not being able to close that off, and still like be okay about the mess that we're in?
Yeah, I think that's where I'm at right now. I'm on the path, and then it's like I can't go back, but how do you go forward living where we live and how we live? So, yeah, that's cool. So now let's unravel. How the hell did you get there? I mean, that's a lot. Where were you born?
I was born in Victoria in Melbourne, or in Frankston. So that's in Australia, down the bottom of Australia for people that aren't Australian. And it's kind of a coastal area. Both my parents grew up in the same suburb, and so all of our family still kind of live there. But after a couple of years, they moved to a really tiny little town that was sort of still only just growing on the in East Gippsland, down on the coast still. And so this was a tiny town that was 7 metres long by 4 metres wide on a little peninsula that stuck out of the bottom of Victoria, and mostly bush. So that was my upbringing, was down there. Very tiny town. I think the most people we ever had at the school were 60, you know, in the primary school. So a really close-knit community.
And what led your parents there from Frankston? Because Frankston, at least I know now, is a, you know, it's a, I think it's a pretty much blue collar, working class type suburb, isn't it?
Definitely.
And there's a lot of, you know, low socioeconomic and the problems that come along with that there. Were they escaping something like that or did they just want to go bush?
Probably a bit of both, actually. My dad was a like a telephone linesman, I guess that's what you call them.
Okay.
So, and because the town that we moved to was so new, there was heaps of work for him as the person that was putting in the phone lines. So I think that was one of the appeals. But, yeah, they must have liked the idea of just going a bit out of the world, you know, moving away into – and we did have a relative down there as well. I'm sure that helped.
Okay. And so – The reason I'm asking about your parents is, you know, sometimes I have someone like you in the podcast and I'm like, were your parents hippies? Like, did you have an indoctrination into the way you see the world at the moment or did you have to grow out of that?
No, they definitely had hippie elements, yeah. So
Okay, cool, cool. That makes it easier.
Yeah. Yeah, my dad is definitely a free spirit, but maybe a very uncontained free spirit, but my mom, when they split up when I was in my teens, she went deep in on the hippie new age kind of 90s vibe. So that really launched me into my world a lot more too, just being having access to the people.
And so you kind of followed her a bit that way?
Well, I mean, I was exposed to similar people. So she was into Reiki and we used to have Reiki workshops in our house. There would be people channeling aliens in our house. Like this was just all normal everyday stuff, you know, when I was like 14, 15. What it did was, you know, because it was a small area, there was near our little town was Isale in Victoria, which you would probably know. So that's a kind of major town for Victoria, I guess. And so there was like this hippie shop. And so my mum was connected to those people, which then brought me into that. And so at that time in the world was like where witchcraft was really big in the media. You know, we had The Craft, we had Charmed, we had Buffy the Vampire Slayer. So I wouldn't say I went in the same direction as my mum, but I had access because of her. And then I accessed kind of the other elements of the same kind of world, you know, that new spiritual earthy kind of world. And we were doing organic food and all those sorts of things.
Oh, really? Okay. So that's when you're in your teens. What came next? Like, you know, you're at the point where you've got to start, you know, earning a living, trying to put food in your mouth. Where did you go from there?
Well, so I went off to uni to be a writer and because I worked out that really one of the only things I liked was having a pen in my hand and I just thought, being a writer would be a good way to do that, which is ridiculous because you do most of your writing on a computer or a typewriter or whatever. So I went off to Canberra to uni because I didn't make it into Melbourne. And Canberra is the capital city of Australia. It's not as big as Melbourne or Sydney.
ANU?
I went to the University of Canberra, so smaller than the ANU. There was actually only three creative writing courses in Australia at the time. One was in Melbourne, one was in Ballarat, which is, you know, in the middle of nowhere, and there was one in Canberra. So I thought, okay, I'll go to Canberra. And then I heard from someone when I was moving there that Canberra had some of the biggest ratio by population of pagans and witches in Australia. And so I thought, sweet, this is just my place. Now, I don't know if that's true and I don't know where that, you know, in those days, nobody was doing that on the census. There was not pagan on the census. So I don't know how we think that was a stat. But certainly there was a community there. And so I was able to find other people that were interested in witchcraft and I started running events because I've just always been a person who, if the thing that I want to do is not there, I'll just run it and then it'll be happening. So I did a lot of that, got myself a witchcraft shop, did that for a while, met my partner.
A witchcraft shop. Tell me about a witchcraft shop.
Yeah. So, again, because there wasn't anywhere in Canberra to buy witchy things and I wanted to have witchy things like knives and statues and herbs and, you know, T-shirts that had witchy things on them, whatever, anything, I just started like a little market stall and then that grew into a store. And then in that time when I had my market stall, I had one of my teachers having a stall next to me. He was a tarot reader and he somehow got me roped into teaching foundational witchcraft at a night school, like a night college, which I just kind of, it just started happening. I didn't know what I was doing. I just worked it out, went and taught that. And so I suddenly kind of had this public figure as a witch, and I was on the front of the local paper and magazines and all these things.
Oh, really?
And so I just kept doing it. While people were interested, I just kept doing it.
What year is this?
2005, I think I opened the store. So I would have had the market stall a bit before that. Yeah.
And did you get any pushback from people in 2005 being on the front page of the paper as a witch?
No, it was really interesting because all of the articles that the paper ever did on us, like us as a community of witches, you know, they'd be like, oh, there's this secret witchy community that's, you know, having nighttime circles in the park, and they try to make it all creepy sounding. And they would always front it with this like, oh, it's very alternative to the main religions. But the reality was the main religions were kind of having a downturn anyway at that point. And I think Canberra's a fairly educated, you know, most people are university trained. Like, yeah. It just was not really ever a thing that I experienced. And my shop was like in the main part of the city. So we could have had it, but it never happened.
Really? Yeah, it's interesting these days that the more educated a person is, the less likely to be attracted to mainstream religions.
Yeah.
They are. And, you know, and the reason I ask that question is because there's a perception, you know, from the movies or whatever, about witchcraft as it's with the idea that it's only about bad things.
Exactly.
And it's you know, it's like, I don't know if you listened to the podcast with Rupert Isaacson. Did you ever listen to that one?
Yeah, of course. He's great.
You know, Rupert talking about the hunter gatherers and the shamans and stuff. And the hunter gatherer, he said the hunter gatherers only ever used shamanism for good. Oh. Whereas when they got into herding societies, things like that, once they got away from being hunter gatherers, then they would use that energy for good and bad. But apparently the hunter gatherers, at least according to Rupert, only ever used it for good. And that was, you know, that shamanism would fall under the umbrella of witchcraft if you dressed it up, you know, the same way. So, and it's, you know, I'm really into, you know, looking at our hunter gatherer roots these days, and there was shamanism in all of them. And that was the doctor. That was the psychiatrist. That was the healer. That was what kept your mind and body on the straight and narrow sort of thing. And so if you think about that, that were the witches.
Yeah, definitely.
But the term witch in, you know, in our society, it has a certain connotation that, you know, makes you think of Elvira if your mind goes one way. Or, you know, you think of sexy Halloween witch, or you just think of warts on noses and frog's legs in a pot, or you think of really bad things. But it's, you know, it's really about, isn't it really about connecting with nature and spirit and divine energy sort of thing, you know?
Yeah, well, it is for me, for sure. I mean, it's like ask 10 different witches the definition of witch and you'll get 11 different answers. Like, everyone's probably going to be slightly different. But, yes, I think you're exactly right about it. The roots are there in every culture, in, you know, every way of being that existed before we started to settle and had to protect things and had to, you know, yeah, like, you know, hold our special property in a certain way. And, like, so over time, like, I think witchcraft and magic moves with the culture. And so the different iterations that we see or that we think we know about it is just a reflection of the culture at the time. And I think now, I mean, I feel like it might be a bit different in the States, because when I've been interviewed by people in the States, they often go down that line of asking, like, have the Christians gone after you or any of that sort of stuff? And it's always surprising to me because it's not something that I've experienced here in Australia. But I do think that does still happen. But really, we're all just kind of doing the same thing, just with different tools. That's what it comes down to, right? We're trying to know ourselves better. We're trying to know the divine better. We're trying to, well, for me, it's about living as closely in connection, but also in relationship with the world around me. And I think that's what most religions are trying to do in one way or another.
Yeah, Most certainly. So when you said you had the stall and the guy next door was a tarot reader, but he was a teacher of yours, was he a teacher at your university?
No, he's a Norse dude, and he is a shaman. So I was training Norse shamanism under him and also learning tarot from him. And he'd had a tarot store in Canberra for years before, and he's quite well known and, you know, gets around with all the regalia, looks like a big old shamanic Viking dude.
Does he? So you forgot to add Nordic shamanism and what was the other thing you just said?
Tarot.
Oh, yeah. You forgot to add that to your long list of stuff in your bio there too.
Put all the things. Well, and they're kind of covered, right? They're covered by sacred spaces, altered spaces, magic. Yes. Yep. You know, it's under that bend, that umbrella. Yeah.
Yeah. So the reason I wanted to go into the whole witch thing right then as early as possible, even though we're 25 minutes in, is there is a, you know, there is a portion of the people that listen to this podcast that may have heard that word and went, this ain't for me. And I want to try to get to the point to where it's not what you think it is. It may not be what you think it is, but it's certainly not bad stuff. It's more along the lines of how we evolved to live anyway.
Yeah, and I think using that word is a bit of a rebellious act. Like, it's a radical act to kind of bring that attention to exactly what you just said. Like, you know, by actively reclaiming a word that has been demonized or, you know, made into a bad thing, we can start to redefine that and give people other ways of thinking about the world and how they relate to it. Yeah. But it is always a question, do you put that in the beginning of your bio or do you push it down a bit for exactly the reason you just said?
You know, you want to kind of put it out there so that you can reframe people's mind about it. But my people-pleasing tendencies immediately went to, oh, God, how many people have stopped listening because we said witch?
Possibly, yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. That's honest truth. That's why I was going there. That's what I was thinking. I'm thinking, oh, how many people are going to miss out on the good stuff because she said witch?
and I think that's probably one of the reasons I use it, because if someone is not quite able to step over that hump and be a bit more open-minded, then they're not going to like anything else I do anyway, let's be honest.
Well, see, that tells you that you're just a little more evolved than I am, because I'm still in the people-pleasing tendencies. Like, I've got to dress it up so that everybody can hear the message, not just the people who are ready to hear the message. And that's the thing I've got to think about with that stuff, totally getting off track here, but some people aren't ready to hear the message, and that's okay.
Yeah, or they get it in a different way.
They'll get it at some point in time. It's just not right now, and I've got to be okay with that, because we delve into some esoteric subjects here on this podcast, but I'm always trying to keep, like, I want everybody to listen, not because I want the numbers to go up, but I want everybody to get the juice out of all the cool stuff that you guys talk about. I don't want you to run off at the start, but yeah, it was interesting while you were talking, and I was sitting here kind of thinking about my motives for saying that. And so I thought I need to blurt it out. That's my ADHD tendencies right there too.
But it's great.
I do a lot of blurting.
It's awesome, but naming for people though too, right? To name that and to say, like, oh, I'm feeling a bit nervous about we're using these words. Like, I wonder how you're feeling. Like, you're still getting the message there, just in a different way.
Right, yeah. Okay, so you've gone to uni. You are taking a degree in writing. You are now teaching the witchcraft class at the local.
Yeah. Yep, the night college. Yeah,
that's cool. And so, okay, so tell me, when you're teaching a witchcraft class, who's what are the age group and you know, who are the people coming? Is there a certain part of the community, or it's like, oh,
it was so
John the accountant
wild. It was so wild and weird, because it was, you know, like, I'm sure you guys have, I don't even know if it's still a thing in Australia, but we used to have, it was quite strong, like that nighttime college adult, you know, kind of hobby education. Like, you can just go and do these short courses. So it was that, and it was all sorts of people, and it was, like lawyers and accountants. And then there was the people that were already into psychic stuff and just wanted to know more. And then there was people that would just scan the little book and be like, oh, that's different, I'll do that. And so it was such a strange range. But it was a great add-on for me, because then people would come and buy stuff from me. from my business, right? So that was the benefit for me. And I got paid to do the teaching, and it was a great way for me to really hone my skills on teaching. I think I learned so much so quickly because of the range of people. Like, they weren't all there just to go, yes, tell us what we want to hear. They would question me, and they would give different ideas. Or so it was a huge steep learning curve.
You know, there's an old saying about if you want to learn something really well, teach it. Did you find, because I find like giving clinics and stuff, I will be saying, I'll be explaining something to somebody, and I've said it a million times before, but it'll come out in a way that I've never said before. And when it comes out, I now realize I understand it on a deeper level than I have before. Did you have that
definitely
coming through you a lot?
Definitely. Yeah. I'm definitely a learn it better by teaching it. And I always teach with notes and a clipboard and a pen. And when I have one of those epiphanies, I quickly write it down so that I can go back and change the program or, you know, just keep rebuilding and adding to that. That's the really exciting part about teaching, I think. And then hearing people's reflections, and then that, you know, locks something into your brain, takes you to the next level. I really enjoy teaching. I'm really grateful to Gare for kind of tricking me into doing those lessons, because it really was a great benefit to everything I do now.
I really feel teaching is like an exchange of energy. Mm. And, you know, you say something and you sense the energy coming back, and the energy might be a little like, I'm not quite sure. And so there's maybe not a lot of dialogue from the people you're teaching, but there's facial expressions and there's body language and there's energy, and you're kind of like, they're getting it, they're not getting it, can I say it a different way? And I really think it's the saying the same thing 5 million different ways that gives you that possibly that deeper level of understanding of it. You know, if everybody was nodding their head going, yeah, and you just said the same thing the same way every time, you might not get that.
Mm, yeah. And it's just clarifying, isn't it? You just keep clarifying yourself with, yeah, different people or different people's interpretations. And yeah, I really like being challenged in teaching. It's very valuable.
So this was a while ago. Where did you go from, where'd you go from there?
Well, I had my store for a few years, and then so at that time I was a single mum. By the end of that stage, single mum, two kids, like one was still a toddler. My daughter was born when I was at the shop, not literally at the shop, but I was pregnant with her in the shop.
Yeah.
And so I was quite burned out, which I now think is a lot to do with autism, which I've only recently found out over the last few years. Just the intensity of people coming in all the time was the burnout. It wasn't doing the work. It wasn't, you know, because we had a temple space where people could come in. It was called the Goddess Shrine, and it was the only public feminine divine space in the city and probably in the country. So we had this huge statue of sort of an archetypal feminine image, and people could come in and put little prayers on the altars and light candles and, you know, do blessings, all these sorts of things. And once a month we would take all of that and do a certain ceremony where we kind of zhuzhed it all up and magicked it out into the universe. So there was this extra space. So people were coming in all the time for that. People obviously shopping, and I was just totally burned out from people, you know, the people of the world. So I closed up after a few years and started working from home, doing a lot of online things, running a lot of circles, moved into working only with women at that stage, which was a sort of another way for me to be less burned out, because I could only just focus on that one area of, you know, the mysteries. And that was quite a few years of doing that. Then at some point I walked outside my backyard and I saw the lady in the back, like the next house over, standing on her porch, waving to me in the morning in her dressing gown. And I was in my dressing gown, and I thought, I don't want to live like this. I don't want the neighbors waving to me when I'm not even awake yet. So we moved to the country.
Okay, that's a big move. Before we move to the country, let's back up a bit, if I can go there.
Sure,
because you just said something that might really resonate with a lot of people. Is said you, looking back now, you didn't know, but it was your autism that you've recently found out about. Do you care to talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I can talk about that heaps, yeah.
Because I think I think I'm on the spectrum somewhere. I haven't been diagnosed ADHD either, but I've had my wife and I were seeing online. We're seeing a marriage counsellor a few years ago, and during one of my blurt outs, the counsellor looks at me in the screen and goes, you have ADHD? Well, I haven't been diagnosed, but you're not the first therapist to ask me that question. So, and it's not a, you know, I don't think it's a, there's a stigma about it. It's actually nice to know. For me, it's nice to know why my mind works the way it works. It's a thing. It's not, I think it takes the judgment and blame off yourself and like, oh, you know, yeah, it's a common thing. It's, you know, I've got webbed toes, okay? So two of my toes have webbing in between them. Well, apparently it's a common thing. But when I was a kid, I thought I was weird. You know what I mean? So it's that whole, you know, when you become vulnerable and you share something deep and dark about yourself, you always think people are going to laugh at you, and you always get, yeah, me too.
Absolutely.
So yeah, sorry, that was my rant about me asking you about this, because I'm sure a lot of people resonate with it. I'm sure.
No, sorry. I totally agree. Absolutely. And yeah, the thing for me around the diagnosis for autism is being able to recognize so many of the things that I probably judged myself for or thought, you know, thought there was some sort of wrongness about me, and just going, oh, yes. Yeah, there's another autism. Oh, that's an autism thing. Oh, that's an autism thing. And then being able to relax into that, I guess, like, you know, just realize like, oh, this thing that's happening to me right now is part of that picture, and it's part of my nervous system, and it's long, like it's deep, you know, it's not something I learned as an adult. It's deep within my nervous system, and it takes a different level of attention and consciousness for me to be able to stay conscious with it, and for it not to just be my automatic response. Yeah. And that's not to say that there's a certain way of being, like that people should be a certain way. But when we get overwhelmed or things like that, it's nice to know, okay, this is what's happening, and I know what I can do about it so I don't feel overwhelmed. And also, I'm still autistic. Like, that's not going to go away from me.
Right. It's not, you're not trying to cure anything.
Yeah. Yeah. That's it. So yeah, it's been, you know, really life changing. And I used to think that I just had some sort of trauma because I could watch all these responses that were happening or reactions that were happening inside me. And obviously as a psychotherapist, like I know all of that stuff, you know,
and right. You're self-aware enough to know what they are. You know how to work through them and figure out where they come from. And you thought it was a trauma.
Yeah. I just thought, okay, well, I'm doing all the things that people with trauma have. So this, maybe it's childhood trauma, but I couldn't, there was no real, oh yeah, this thing happened to me or this series of things happened to me to make my system so reactive. But now I go, oh no, that's because it was actually an autism reaction, not a trauma reaction, which look very, very much the same. I think the difference is that one's with us from when we're born and one happens to us sometimes in our lives at some point in our life and then sticks around.
Right. So what about how did you end up getting the diagnosis? Did you think, I think, and you went somewhere, or someone said to you, hey, have you ever thought of this?
So when I was young, my mum always worked with autistic young boys. And so this is, you know, early through the 90s when our idea of autism was very clearly, you know, like the Rain Man or the, you know, like the really heavy duty sort of not so functioning in the normal society. And so I always had an awareness of what that looked like. And I had an awareness of the kind of traits that an autistic person would have. And so I used to always joke like, oh, that's just my autism, or that's just my ADHD, or, you know, like, and it was sort of a joke, but I was sort of aware that it was a thing that most people didn't do. But it was just a weird, quirky thing, you know. And then actually doing therapy with other people, and I had a few women coming through that were getting diagnoses, and they were describing everything that they were experiencing that was my experience. And I'm trying to be their therapist to do all the right things. And in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, oh, shit, this is me.
So you're the therapist. They're your client, and they're telling you stuff, and they're telling you about their diagnosis from somewhere else. So that's how you go.
Yeah.
So that's neither. That is, I had two options. Like, did you think there's something going on here? Or did someone say, hey, I think there's something going on there? But you heard someone else's story. It's just the
their
thing
experience.
You like, when you're vulnerable about stuff and you don't get, that's weird. You get, yeah, me too. Well, you're the therapist. They're being vulnerable about stuff and you're thinking, yeah, me too.
Yeah. Wow, and what I started to notice, like, so then, yeah, I started to sort of, I was listening to these clients, and then I was looking at, decided to do my own research and going, oh yeah, shit, no, this is definitely me. So I went and got the you know, the assessment, and I actually got assessed for ADHD and autism. He couldn't, in Australia at least, we can't say there's ADHD unless it was something that people could see before the age of 12. So you might notice it from school reports, or parents would say, oh yeah, they were always like that. And they couldn't really get any evidence of that from me. So what they thought was that I'm probably just autistic, but there's like been different levels of stress in my life that's kind of added some of those ADHD symptoms that wouldn't usually be in an autism profile, but they haven't been there since the beginning. You know, all my school teachers were like, no, she was the most focused kid in the room. Like, she was so into it. But I was also like, I also recognize that I'm hyperlexic. So that's, if you think about the spectrum of dyslexia, which we all recognize, and hyperlexia is on the other end of that spectrum. So I can see a word and memorize it immediately. I can, you know, I was reading from the age of three. I was reading to the older classes at school, reading picture storybooks to them to keep them busy while the teachers had a meeting in the staff room. You know, that was an area of interest for me. So I kind of flew under the radar at school because I was so good at the writing and the words stuff.
I've never heard that term before, hyperlexic. Really? So what else? So is it, I'm intrigued now, like you said, you remember stuff. Is it like a photographic memory?
I don't think
so. Is there a part of that too? No?
I don't really understand photographic memory, so that would be a good thing to kind of look
at. I think photographic memories, they can almost conjure the picture back up and, like, say, read the page. Whereas it's probably with you, it was more like you knew it. You didn't have to think of a picture of it to read it off the page. You knew the thing.
Exactly, yeah. Wow. And if there's a strange word, I'll ask someone to spell it to me, and then my brain can catch it with the letters. You know, so I don't necessarily have to see the letters, but if my brain can process it as letters, I guess, is a big part of what happens, which is obviously so different to that other end of the spectrum where someone with dyslexia sees the letters and it makes it more difficult to process. Yeah, so it's something about the organization of the way my brain picks up information that's somehow related to letters and words. Yeah.
Yeah, well, I think every single brain is completely different, and they all, yeah, they all work in different ways. And, you know, for years, you know, the therapist community or whatever would take people with very similar type brains and say, well, that's that particular thing or whatever, but, yeah, we're all different. Speaking of brains, did you end up getting your university degree?
Yeah, so I have a writing university degree, and then later I went back to school for psychotherapy, obviously, and for counselling.
Yeah, so we're still in the hippie phase here. We're still in the witchy phase. What I'm trying to get at here at some point in time is if we're done with the autistic bit, because I don't want to not hear part of that story, but I do want to get from how we got from teaching witch classes to being a psychotherapist.
Yeah,
but you are still on the on the autism thing. We got off track when you told me how they discovered it. Clients telling you, sorry, let's get back to that bit. Yeah.
So, which bit do you want? You want the autism bit or the?
I was trying to get to how did you figure it out, and you're telling me that you had clients telling you that they had this diagnosis because of this and this and this, and you're kind of like, well, I've got all those things too.
Yeah, and then when I started to look at my books, like, from the therapy perspective, and just look at all the people and look at my marketing, right? So the way that my marketing is written, even though it doesn't say neurodiversity in it anywhere, it actually just defines an autistic woman or ADHD woman that's under a lot of pressure. Yeah. And I thought, oh, and then I looked at all of my case, you know, all the cases that I was working with, and I thought, oh, like at least 90% of these women are all neurodivergent. Whether or not they relate to that is irrelevant, but it helps me understand them because now I'm like, oh, okay, this is how their brain works. And it just gives me that extra piece of information. Some of them will identify and some of them will just be like, oh, no, I don't believe in labels, which is definitely, I've been there in my life. And so that's fine. But yeah, it was really interesting to see that like attracts like, you know, and I've had this conversation with friends a lot where they're like, yeah, but isn't everybody like that? And I say, no, it's just us. Like, we hang out together. And so it feels really normal for us to be the way we are. But actually, apparently, there are people out in the world that are not like us at all.
That's one of those things in life when you get to the point where you realize not everybody thinks, you know, this, or, you know, colorblind people see mayonnaise is green, you know, whatever. Yeah. Like, people sense the world differently. than you. And then, you know, then you start to get, well, you've been there all along, but you start to get to be aware of others. Like for me, I had five senses and now I'm starting to be aware of this. Oh, there's other senses that can be developed, whereas you've been down that rabbit hole for a long time. But yeah, just that whole getting that everybody does it a bit differently, landmark.
Yeah. And I think I already had that because of growing up in that hippie house. You know, I remember friends coming over and us eating what I thought was a totally normal meal. And people were just like, what is this? I've never seen this type of thing before. So it was pretty early on that I realized, oh, yeah, we're not like other people. And that's just grown in so many different kind of branches the older I've got, you know.
I didn't ask you, how did you get along at school if you were one of those alternative kids?
So, I mean, the alternative stuff really kicked in the high school era, and I was definitely, I would now say I'm an edge walker and always have been. I think that's a really nice way to define that, you know. So I wouldn't say I was unpopular, but there was definitely, you know, the cliques that weren't into the alternative world that I was into. But at the time, it was really popular in the 90s to be into witchy things and gothic things. And
I suppose that's right. This is Buffy the Vampire Slayer time. And
yeah. So it wasn't so bad. Yeah. And even in a country school.
I'm an Aussie. You know? Right. I'm an Aussie. This is post-internet, isn't it?
It's the beginning of the internet, really. Yeah. Okay. It's like I remember being in the school library learning about the internet. It's right at the beginning.
Right. Okay. Because I was thinking about, I don't think there was any kids like that at my school when I was going to high school, and they would have definitely been made fun of if they had been.
Yeah. But I mean, I definitely was made fun of.
It's another generation.
Yeah. I was definitely made fun of, but then, see, I had the karate background as well. And so right. I remember certain situations where I'd be at like a fair or something and we'd be doing an expo because I was a black belt from a very young age. So I was always in all of the spaces where the exhibitions were happening. And I can remember like being there and seeing people from school that might be judgy, and then they'd see me do things and suddenly they just never looked at me again. I think that was, you know, as much as I'm not into violence, I think the standing in your power ability really keeps the boundary away.
Yes, that's the thing, isn't it? I'm a big Brené Brown fan. Don't puff up, don't shrink back, just hold your sacred space. That's a,
That's great.
Yeah, I talk about it a lot with the horses too, because there's an energy you have to have that's not a pushing energy or a get away from me or a defensive energy, but you also can't have this shrink back, I'm scared energy. You've just got to be there. And for a lot of people, it's hard to be like that next to a, you know, 500-kilo farm animal sort of thing that in their mind makes irrational decisions or does erratic things, or, you know, which they horses don't. But yeah, so it's kind of the same thing. Like
100%.
You know, martial arts, being around horses, they're just disciplines that there's something that interests you, and the more you try to get into it, the more it challenges you in those ways. But it's not about, you know, you're not doing martial arts because you want to beat somebody up and you're really the horse thing. Eventually, at some point in time, you're not really trying to win a prize or whatever, you know.
Absolutely. Yeah, well, that's definitely my horse journey, which we'll get to eventually.
Do you have anything you want to share? I want to probably get off the talking about the autism thing, but is there anything you want to share about how your life is different because you now know what that thing is? Like is there a different less judgments about things you do?
Yeah, definitely less judgment and more comfort in designing my life in a way that is actually appropriate for me. So whether that's for my senses, just in terms of, you know, I do not go into town where I can get caught in small talk, particularly if I've got a busy week at work, you know, because I'm talking to people all day, every day as a therapist. A lot of the work is online and I put all of my energy into that. So then moving myself into like everyday chit chat is actually like really jarring for my system and exhausting and draining. So I just don't do it anymore. And I feel really confident about that. But I think before I was trying to do both because that's just what you do. And it was exhausting, you know. So that's an example of, change. But sensory stuff too, like realizing that, okay, it's a big week and I might be more stressed than usual. So I'm going to eat certain things that don't take as much energy, you know, like it's just easier to eat. The texture's easier, the flavor's easier. I think just lots of things like that I think about now differently.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Thanks for sharing. That's awesome. Okay. So when do we start to go back to school to be a psychotherapist, and what led to that decision?
Yeah, so at the end of the shop days, part of the other reason that I finished up was because I'd had this just this weird virus that put me in hospital for about 4 or 5 days, and I just met my partner at that stage, so that was lucky because I had little kids, but they couldn't work out what was wrong with me, and it was like I was in hospital unconscious, and I'd wake up and it'd be like, you know, that TV show House, where there'd be like all the doctors with their clipboards, like commenting or whatever. Yeah. It was like that. Every time my eyes opened, there was like this pile of people around me all talking about me like I wasn't there. It was just the weirdest thing. And then I'd pass out again. And so this went on for days, and then I'd go home, and then I'd have to come back because my temperature would keep peaking like over 40 degrees. I don't know what that is in Fahrenheit, but it's very high. So anyway, eventually they decided that there was nothing wrong with me and they sent me home. But then I had what I think people now call like post-viral chronic fatigue, right? So I had this long, long chronic fatigue that I just couldn't do any of the things that I used to be able to do. And I'd do like one day of teaching and then I'd be down for a week sort of thing. So that was another part of the reason why I closed the shop, moved to the country, and tried all the ways to get myself well, all the ways I already knew from natural health. I spoke to doctors, I spoke to so many practitioners. And in the end, there was a day when I heard a podcast with Ben Greenfield and Jack Cruz, which completely changed my life. And that was when I started to focus on mitochondrial wellness, which is kind of what we're talking about when we say ancestral wellness, right? So it's all the things that I think are really common now. But in those days, it was all woo and new and everyone thought Jack was crazy. I'm sure people still do. But it really just changed my brain into thinking about, all right, this is how we think about health now. If we think about everything is energy, everything is electrons, our body needs to collect as many electrons as we can from the world around us. And so that's what I'm going to do. So I started going barefoot, having cold baths or cold swims, you know, eating high nutrient density foods that were full of fat that were just like, you know, really nutritious, all these kind of things that eventually got me out of the chronic fatigue. And I did that by myself. Wow. And so after that, when I was actually well enough, I was kind of talking to some of my practitioners, like my osteopath, and he said, "Why aren't you teaching people this?" And I was like, "I'm not anybody. I can't teach this kind of science, you know?" And he was like, "No, you have to, because this is like a pretty amazing story." So I started to play around with like, what kind of profession would I need to have insurance that would be appropriate for me to be able to share this knowledge? And so I landed on counseling. In Australia, you don't really have to have a license to be a counselor. Anyone can actually call themselves a counselor. But if you want to be insured, you have to have the licensing. And of course, you know, counselors and therapists don't just listen to emotions. Sometimes we're giving psychoeducation about things or, there's lots of ways that we work with a person. So I thought that was a way in. So I went and did a nighttime course part-time for a few years, and here we are.
So, you know, there's a number of people that suffer with chronic fatigue, and you're saying that you cured yourself of it. What were the names? What's the name of the guy? Because people are going to be emailing me like, "What was the name of that guy?"
Okay. So his name is Jack Cruz with a K, K-R-U-S-E. He is very controversial because the way he goes about delivering his information is pretty hardcore. So he's not for everybody. But his method, he says, is he shares his knowledge and people like us pick it up and then starfish it out. So absolutely go and look at his stuff. But if you find him offensive, which I feel like sometimes he purposely is offensive, then there's certainly other ways you can find it these days. Like this is, we're talking like 2015, 14, you know, so okay, it was really early days. But now I think the information's everywhere, you know, everyone, well, maybe not everyone, but it's a lot more common to think about being barefoot. It's a lot more common to be thinking about being on the beach instead of in the city. Like people are starting to get this information. But at the time he was sort of piecing together the science and then delivering it in such a way that it was kind of building, one piece would build on the next, you know. But yeah, certainly go and have a look at it.
And it's all science, but what is he telling you to do?
Yeah, just be like a normal human.
Live like a hunter-gatherer.
Exactly.
We've got to have like three PhDs to tell you to live like you used to.
Exactly, yeah. And it really is those pillars of, you know, sunshine and clean, healthy, bubbling water and grounding, like magnetism. They are the pillars. That's all it comes down to, you know. Turn your Wi-Fi off at night. Go outside with your shoes off. That's going to give you so much stuff, you know. Eat food that actually belongs out of the soil or out of the water or off, you know, off the land. Don't eat the things that come in boxes. Like it's like you say, it's not rocket science, but putting the pieces together is the piece there, I think. Yeah. And actually turning off to a lot of what we're told, like, you know, in Australia, we just get pummeled about sun and how dangerous it is. And that is not the way that Jack goes about it at all. So that's like a pretty intense teaching there that people feel really uncomfortable about because, you know, we've all grown up being told you should never go outside in the sun. And if you burn, then that's it. Cancer forever sort of thing. And that's not what it looks like from the science or from our ancestors, right?
You know, it's a bit like the whole, it's the same with like the confluence of science and spirituality these days. The science is proving the spirituality, and for a long time it's been one's right and one's wrong. You know, one on the other side says the other one's wrong. Well, they were both right, and it's kind of the same thing with what you're talking about.
Definitely.
About here, you know, like the educated people say that, the you know, like when they first say colonialized Australia, these people are heathens. Same thing in the United States, these people are heathens, you know what I mean? Whereas we're scientific, they're spiritual. Well, you get far enough along, they're both talking about the same thing. So, yeah,
it's really interesting. All the answers are there.
And same thing in mental health stuff these days. You know, the science behind a lot of that goes back to, once again, you know, hunter-gatherer type stuff. I've talked about it before on the podcast, but I was reading a book a while ago. I forget what it was about, but in this book they said they'd been around the world and tested toddlers on certain protein levels and lots of different things. But anyway, one of the things I was testing on proteins level, and there was this group of toddlers in Uganda that had protein levels that were off the charts compared to anybody else in the world, and in a good way, like we would want to have the rest of the world have those proteins. And they finally figured out what they did differently there. As a toddler, they were never put down. They were always held against the human body.
That's amazing. Oh, I love that. Grandmother, I haven't mother, seen or whatever. That work. Yeah.
And so if you think about that, if that didn't happen to us, we're not wired properly from the start. From out of the box, the way we're supposed to be has got a faulty wire in it already.
Yep.
And that's like it's that – when I learned that, that was like – that's the start of it, and then it goes downhill from there because of, and not blaming anybody, just saying because of the way we're culturally and societally taught things work, we've got so far away from how we're supposed to work.
Definitely. And that's what I started to piece together was all that physical stuff, but then starting to go down that journey of understanding polyvagal theory and understanding everything that you're talking about around attachment and seeing how that actually plays into our health too in so many ways. And so bringing those two ideas together. And so that's kind of a piece of my body of work is around like, how do we bring the physical in with that mental and emotional space? Because they're all equally important. Actually, the environment is important. Spirituality is important. Emotions, mental health, you know, like they're all pillars and the physical health. And I think our culture really just focuses on physical and not much else, you know, or mental. Like we still haven't quite put the two pieces together in a lot of practices.
Yeah, the therapist doesn't ask you how your leg feels and the doctor doesn't ask you how your heart feels.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that's slowly changing. I think especially in the therapy world, it's definitely changing. But I think we've got a long way to go within the medicine industry just because of the way that that system works. It's going to take a lot longer to get there. I think we'll get there eventually. But meanwhile, we might as well all grassroots just do the work that we are seeing and we know and that our ancestors have always known.
All right. You mentioned much earlier on, I forgot to get back to it, that you are a licensed psychedelic assisted therapist. Is that what it's called in Australia?
Yeah, so we're not licensed yet because for Australia it's very new, this idea. We've only just had a ruling that says that it's even allowed to be a thing, and it's still very restricted.
See, that's the thing is, so I had a podcast guest, Dr. Will Tzu, who's a psychedelic assisted therapist, and he's, you know, good friends with, what's the guy from MAPS?
Yes.
Rick Doblin.
Yeah, that's his name.
And him and Rick go around the world and do different things together. And the day that Australia, I saw an item in the news that Australia had legalized MDMA and psilocybin for therapeutic use, I messaged it to Will, and he sent me back like big high fives, like they have now become the world leader. If that's what's happening there, that's they're leading the charge with that. So I think that's really, really cool.
Yeah, hopefully. It's going to take some time, I think, just in terms of the procedures and the policies are still happening. There's a group that's formulated called AMAP in Australia, which stands for maybe Australian Multidisciplinary Association of Psychedelic Practitioners. And so that's really, they're doing a lot of that work to try and work out how we're going to make this actually happen now, because we've only got a handful of prescribers that are able to prescribe. We really don't have enough therapists that have the right qualifications according to what they're already saying. Like, it's going to be a little while to get there, but it will. It'll happen, yeah. And, you know, and then it will only be accessible to people with really high needs, like, you know, complex PTSD. But over time, that's going to filter through the community and we'll have better access to it. So, at the moment, as a psychotherapist and a counsellor, I'm not technically, like, I don't have enough of the credentials to be able to sit at yet, but that's going to change over time, and we'll get opportunities to sit and build those credentials up. But I've done the certificate, which is the first stage. And certainly anyone who does those certificates as a therapist, the work is really useful in your practice anyway, regardless of whether you're using psychedelics or not, you know, in terms of integration and just being with people is really great work.
You mentioned holotropic breath work before. Do you do much of that with people?
I don't usually take people through it. At my retreats, we do. Once a year, we do so each of my retreats has like a deep ceremony at nighttime, and one of those will always be holotropic breath work. But I've done a lot with friends who are practitioners. So I've, you know, sat in for a lot of those and done my own holotropic work. I think it's magic. And I always say to people, like, there's so many ways to get those altered states outside of psychedelics. And if you haven't done any of those, you actually have no business doing mushrooms or MDMA or anything else. Like, you need to, we all need to start in a way where we can control the system a little bit. You know, we have the choice of coming in and out. And I think something like breathwork really allows that.
Yeah. I actually did, I've only done holotropic breathwork once, I think, and it was at an ayahuasca weekend. And so, you know, we had an ayahuasca ceremony Friday night. We had one Saturday lunchtime, and then Saturday night before the nighttime ayahuasca ceremony, we did the holotropic breath work. It was way better than the ayahuasca. But the something I didn't think of was what you just said, was you can regulate it. Like, if you were feeling a bit overwhelmed, you could just slow your breathing down and it would go away. I never thought of that. And I was like, yeah, that's great, because otherwise, you know, with the psychedelics, the only way out is through, sort of thing, and that can be scary for some people.
And, yeah, and, you know, people talk about, oh, you have to have that ego death. That's that. Only way is through, right? Like, everything has to fall away so that you can have this great epiphany and live a better life. Now, how many people do we know that have ego death after ego death and are still assholes the next week? Like, it's not a guarantee, right? It's about how you come into it, how you relate to it, and then how you integrate out of it is actually the work. And you can do that with so many other altered states and have those little mini ego deaths along the way, but also feel safe in it, you know? Yeah, I just don't think that shaking people to the point of, you know, being so fearful, or, you know, some of those really big things that can happen, even if it's a good trip, you can have those great fears come up, or, you know, relive the traumas. If it's not held well, it's not actually going to be beneficial. So we have to be very careful when we're working in these arenas, because, you know, and then if we start talking about other realities on top of that, you know, tapping into that while you're in those altered spaces is, it's very special work. It's very important to have it, have it held in the right way, I think, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. Amazing stuff. way back a little while ago, you had talked about, you're talking about different things, and you're talking about, oh, you're talking about health and wellness, and it's not just, you know, the doctor, it's, you know, there's the, your emotional wellness. And then, you know, then you said attachment, you know, what your attachments are. And when you said that, it made me think about the Ugandan kids with high proteins. It's like, oh, I bet there's no attachment issues there. And you were talking about attachment issues as in the emotional and mental scarring of that, but there's also the, hey, your proteins aren't where the place they're supposed to be, and that's fascinating.
Absolutely. I just can't even understand why. Like, if I was a medical researcher, that is the area that you want to be looking at. Like, I don't know why you'd look at anything else. Like, have a look there. Like you said, it's straight out of the box stuff. It's such a prolific difference between how we're all living here and those results. And if it all comes down to just the fact that that kid had adult caregivers that were there for them all the time, then we really have to question that, right? Because you can only have that in a society where there's many adult caregivers working together, not little boxes of adult caregivers trying to look after all these little people on their own. So we're already just so in trouble in that sense. Like, let's talk about that. Let's think about that. It's exciting. I'm really excited about that piece of information, Warwick. I'm going to go and look at that more.
I've got to think of what book it was in. So it wasn't a book about childcare. It was a, you know, it was a, one of the sorts of books I read. it wasn't about childcare. It was just as an aside, like, oh, yes. And in, you know, I forget if that, it might have been talking about hunter-gatherer cultures. It certainly wasn't about proteins in children around the world. There was just a little aside, and I'm like, oh, that is fascinating.
Yeah. And it just speaks to security. And, you know, it's that whole idea that, like, if you're not sick in this society, then there's probably something wrong with you, because the society we're in right now is not the way that our nervous systems are, you know, our hardware is designed for. So, yeah, if you're not looking around and going, there's something wrong here, then that's the people that we should be concerned about, right? So that what you're talking about just adds that piece of, like, yeah, there's something missing here. And it could be as simple as just carrying our kids a bit more or living more closely together. And we see, you know, I'm pretty interested in polyvagal theory, and I use that a lot in my therapy work. And when you get down to it, the things that help a vagal system feel better are the things that tribal people have been doing forever. You know, sitting together, making eye contact, telling stories, being around the fire, dancing, making, you know, percussion sounds. Like, these are all simple things that cost nothing that are actually what our bodies are craving to be regulated and feel safe in the world.
You know, it's funny, my horse journey and understanding this stuff have run parallel with the horse journey just in front. So I start to understand something with horses, and then I start to understand with people. And, you know, about probably 8 years ago now, maybe, I had some epiphanies, and I started going from being a horse trainer, as in that's the reason I'm interacting with them, is to elicit a certain behavior, to more relationships type thing. Still, I want to train them in the end, but we're going to go about it this way. And they're a totally different horse. And the training, you know, you realize that, oh, I wouldn't say 90%, but could be 50% of things I learned how to do. I only learned how to do them because I was dealing with a horse with a dysregulated nervous system. You know, maybe there's a bit of freeze state going on there. You know, they're bit dorsal, but they're activated. But and it's been amazing to see. It's like, and it's sometimes hard to explain to other people, especially other horse professionals, to look at, when you look at this differently, you know, it's the whole, when you change the way you look at things, the things you look at change. Just working on nervous system first, then a lot of the problems later on aren't there. And it's exactly the same what you're talking about with the things you're talking about there.
Well, and that's how I got into horses, right? So I was not a horse person, but I loved them when I was little. And I got a horse for my daughter. And of course, we didn't want just one horse, so we had another horse on lease, you know. And the other horse was really dysregulated. And I just thought, okay, well, I know about nervous systems. I don't know nothing about horses. I don't know how they behave, but I know how mammals behave and I know how nervous systems work. And so I just started approaching these horses with that knowledge. And, you know, my daughter and her friend would always say like, no, you don't do it like that. And I'd be like, look, just let me try my way. You guys do your way. That's fine. And I would have these experiences with these horses and be like, oh shit, like this works. Cause we just share nervous systems and everything is about the space right between the nervous systems. And that's always been my journey. So I'm not a rider. Like I try to ride, but it's like, it would be embarrassing if anyone actually saw, you know, I don't come from that perspective. I come from the nervous system perspective. So the way, the relationships I have with my horses is so different. And, you know, yeah, anyway, I won't, you can ask whatever you want about that. I won't keep going on about it, but that I find that really exciting.
That's great. What's really funny is I just said how I came to things. You did the exact opposite. I learned about, you know, I always say that I come from the, I learn the science second. I learn empirically, you know, and then I learn experientially, and then something's working really well, and then I find the science of it. And that was polyvagal theory. I'd started doing things differently with horses and was having a whole different experience than I had before. And then when I started to read about polyvagal theory, I went, that's why it works. I knew what I was doing worked. The horses would tell me it worked, but I didn't know why it worked. I had you had a bit of an inkling like, yeah, maybe they're kind of whatever. But really once you understand how that whole polyvagal theory works, it's like, duh.
Do you think, Warwick, that your mind likes a system? Because like, I find I like the system. Yes. Once you understand the system, it puts all those pieces together, right?
Yeah, and see, I've been thinking about that lately, like with the horses, it's relationship based, but it's still a system.
Mm.
You know what I mean? Whereas I just spent some time with someone who's really into heart math, and she doesn't really have much of a system with the horses. She just does the whole heart math thing with them and their nervous systems. You know, it's like I have to do certain things and communicate certain things about me to get their nervous systems to relax. You know, I'm listening, I'm aware, you know, I'm empathetic, I get you, that sort of thing. And, you know, you basically communicate, you're aware of those social cues and, okay, they're cool around you, but personalized with originally does lots of just nothing. It's not scripted, basically, if you want to put it that way. So there's a lot of ways to do it.
That's right. And I think that's why it's an exciting time because there's so many teachers doing it in different ways so people can pick up wherever they want to be entering from. But I think we're all going to end up in the same place eventually, which is deeper relationship with our animals.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. But, yeah, I just thought it was so interesting. I learned it with the horses and then started to figure out with people and you learn it with people and now you're doing it with the horses. And you had it right when you said I know the mammalian nervous system and I know nervous system states. Yeah, you know more than a lot of people around horses. And I'm not judging them because until here very recently, I had no idea anything about that stuff. And I was pretty darn successful with the horses anyway, you know what I mean? So it's so interesting that's how we kind of ended up in those places.
I love that. It's great. And I just learned, in saying that, now working with the horses regularly, I learned so much more about nervous systems, right? Because they are so much more, I guess, or they can be more vigilant or they're more flighty or, you know, all these words that people use to describe horses, which once you understand the system, you know exactly what's going on. But, and because they're bigger, it's just more intense, right? So I can have someone sitting in the room with me on the couch, you know, talking and having certain body language and I can read that, but the horses show it in every possible way, right? Yeah. Through their body language, through the way they communicate with the environment. So it's super exciting. It's just an area that I can't imagine ever not learning through. It's always something, right?
So you started messing with your daughter's horse, or there was the two of them, and did your experience doing that, is that what led you to the equine assisted therapy?
Yeah. So I mean, it was, again, it's another long round story, but yes, that is what led me to the equine assisted therapy, and starting to realize actually, and, you know, reading some books around it and just going, well, this is what I'm already doing. It's what I'm doing with people. It's what I'm doing with horses. Like, this is, it's just a natural progression. Of course, we're going to end up here. And so now we have this facility with this big arena and, you know, car parks, all these things that people can come, you know, in those days I was still working in town in a little clinic, and now I get to work in my garden, literally, and hang out with my horses. Like, it's just the very best situation to have. And I could see like how all those threads have come together to get here. And then I'm asking like, okay, what happens next now? Because this isn't the end, right? But all the threads have met. So what happens now? It's super exciting.
Yeah, super exciting. What happens now? Don't worry about it. It'll reveal itself to you.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, you just got to be excited about the mystery.
That is probably one of my mantras of life. Just keep following that energy.
Yeah, I talked about the podcast I did about the Gaucho Derby before we got on here today, and at the start of that race, before we even went out into the town, we all went to dinner one night. I don't think I said this in the podcast, but all the competitors went to dinner one night, and I ended up sitting on the end of a table, and there was a spare chair next to me. Kansas Carradine was across from that chair, and a fellow named Todd from Australia was in the other chair. So the last person who arrives, Lady Mary Williams, she sits down next to me. So I don't know. I just meet her. She meets Kansas. She meets Todd. And then Mary says to me, my next door neighbor went to Costa Rica with you last year on a whale watching trip. And then Mary turns to Kansas, and Kansas says, where do you live? And Mary says, I live in Flagstaff, Arizona. And Kansas is like, oh, do you know so-and-so? Oh, yeah, I know them. And then Kansas turns to Todd and says, where do you live? And he says, I live in Barrel, Australia. And Kansas said, I lived in Barrel last year for 6 months, and my kids went to this school. And he goes, oh, my best friend's kids go to that school. You know, like, there was this, it was all happening. And so I knew right then, you know, it's like you, those things start happening, you know something's coming. And when it happens often enough that when you know something's coming, then you just go, oh, okay.
Absolutely.
Something good. Yeah. Well, it's happening, but you're not looking for it. You're just open to it.
I loved you said that in that podcast, the Gaucho podcast, about when you and Kansas got those horses that were the same, like the next to each other horses, right, the friends. And it's like that's the stuff in life where you go, okay, I'm on the right track. Like, I'm definitely, I don't have to think about this. Just keep moving forward because we're right where we're meant
to be. It's just a breadcrumb on the path of life, and that's, you're in the right spot. There was... I talked on the podcast about, you know, that sort of energy happening, and I don't think I told the story, but there's a guy named Nico. I was riding with him one day, and we're riding along, and all of a sudden he stops. We're in the middle of Patagonia, you know. We're riding along, and all of a sudden he stops his horse and gets off and picks up a pair of hobbles on the ground that one of the other competitors in front had dropped. And he looks at me with this strange look, and I said, what? And he said, I've been riding along thinking, you know, the hobbles they gave me are shit. When I get something, I'm going to have to get a new pair of hobbles. Thinking amazing. When he gets to the next vet check, he's going to have to get a new pair of hobbles. And he looks down, and there's a brand spanking new pair of hobbles laying in the middle of the Patagonian desert.
Oh, it's beautiful. It's so good.
There's so much of that going on. And you know, like I said, we were just talking about, you realize you're on the right path, and you just got to be open to, you know, you can't grit your teeth and like, when's it going to happen or what's it going to be? You got to get to where you just, bring it on. I'm ready.
And just being with it as it's happening, you know, it's that whole like, what's in the way is the way. So I think you said something similar in your Gaucho experience, but it's like, you might as well just
be with
whatever's
happening. I said, when it's not going your way, it is going your way.
Exactly. Yeah. And so you might as well just be in the experience, because most of the time you can't actually change. You might be able to change little bits of it, but just go with the flow or go with the energy and you get there. And yeah, everything's supposed to be a little crunchy along the way, right? Sometimes, well, not everything, but sometimes you will have crunchiness because that's life. That's nature. That's the seasons. You know, it's not always sunny. It doesn't always feel good. And it will again.
Yes. This too shall pass.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a big one for me.
But, you know, it's almost like everything is supposed to be that way. Like everything's supposed to be that way. There's supposed to be a scarcity of food at some point in time. There's supposed to be abundance of food at some point in time. You mentioned ice bathing before, and my wife and I have been in the ice baths for quite a while. And it's, you know, we have air conditioned houses and cars, and we have this narrow window that we keep our bodies in, and it's not supposed to live in that. It's supposed to have those highs and lows and those differences between the two. And so anything we can do to stretch those things, whether purposely, like, you know, going from the sauna to the ice bath or whatever, those sorts of things. But the things you're talking about too, to where having the grace to allow the crunchy parts to happen, because we're supposed to have crunchy parts. And I think we get so used to, like, you're trying to get ahead so you can have an easier life. But we forget that we're not supposed to have an easy life.
Well, and after those crunchy bits is when you get to take that next big breath out. Like, you take the breath and then you let that out, and that's the good piece, right? That's the, okay, you know, and we see that with our horses, right? They do that a bazillion times a day. But for humans, for some reason, we have to get it really crunchy before we're willing to take the out breath. You know, it's a practice to get to that point because of the acculturation and the way that our society is. But what if we could just be having out breaths all the time along the way? That's the meaning of life, I think. More out breaths.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting talking to you. I love talking to you, by the way. I've had a number of people on the podcast who kind of have this view on life, like we evolved to live a certain way, and when we were living that way, that's how we were supposed to live. And there's quite a spiritual element to that too, but there's also the housing, you know, what you do, what you expose yourself to, sort of thing. And every time I have someone like that on the podcast, and, you know, I forget what that word, what that line was that your bio said before, it said you had a mostly respectful disregard for the status quo in mainstream culture. When I have people talk about that sort of thing on the podcast, I sometimes think, I wonder who's going to think this is weird. And it's the total opposite. Like, there's a lot of people interested in looking at the world this way, but there's just not a lot of, you know, not a lot of places to find a community of people who are interested the same way. I mean, there is quite a bit, especially with the internet these days, but it's not as mainstream. And, like, so when you, it's really good to get feedback from people on the podcast, you know, listeners to the podcast, when we've had someone like you on there, because sometimes you might feel like you're alone out there, but there's a large number of people interested in this stuff.
Absolutely. And I think we're in a culture where everybody wants to create their system and have their special words that they use for the system that they teach or they, you know, show or whatever. And it's like, but none of that's relevant if you can't integrate that into your everyday life immediately. Like, if you can't go to a workshop and then take that home and make it relevant, like, tomorrow, then what was the point of doing that work, you know? And I'm sure that's probably how you work when you train horses and you teach people to train. It's like, what can I give you now that's relevant immediately? Not, here's this fancy thing that you're going to be able to do in 6 months from now once you practice something else for ages. Like, that's never going to work in this culture.
But that is the thing, like, the thing that you need to know now is the thing that is going to get you the fancy thing in 6 months. You know what I mean?
Yes.
We're not even thinking about the fancy thing in 6 months. It's really about karma yoga. You know, I talk about, you know, one of the most spiritually ancient Hindu practices is karma yoga, and karma yoga is essentially focusing on a task with no thought as to the outcome of that task. That's what you've got to be able to do training horses. You've got to be doing this to do this, not doing this because it's going to get to that, it's going to get to that, because your mind is half there and not here. And it's the same with a martial art or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Mm.
You're not thinking about the next thing in the middle of this thing because it doesn't make this thing work. You know, it's all about being present right there in the moment. So,
definitely. Yeah,
that's all. Yeah. All super cool stuff.
Having been a martial artist from such a young age, I think that was a really helpful piece in how I get to where I'm here now, you know, because it is a mindful practice. Even you know, karate in the 80s was kind of a bit macho, definitely macho, but there's still mindfulness and discipline in there. And if that can be integrated into everyday life and you carry that forward, then it's a transferable skill, right? That's, and I hope that that's how people think about working with their horses too.
Yeah, well, I think it's very much like martial arts. The first reason someone might go to martial arts might be because they want to protect themselves or beat someone up. But you stay there long enough, it's you realize that's got nothing to do with it. And that thing leaves your mind anyway. You're not, you know, you're not running away, you're not puffing up, you're just in your space sort of thing. But then yep. I had a therapist on the podcast, maybe the first year, but she was telling me that her mentor told her the reason you got in can't be the reason you stay in. This is because I think I had asked her, because I asked her, I said, a lot of therapists that I've spoken to had some issues, had some therapy, was amazed in the change in themselves when it happened and said, I want to do this for other people. And she said, yeah, that's right. But a mentor of mine once told me the reason you stay in can't be the reason you get in, which means you got to get in and heal your stuff.
And grow.
The reason, they got you, it got you in there, and it's kind of the same with that.
Mm-hmm. I think that's everything in life. That's a great little motto. It's like if you're not moving to something else, then you're not growing. Nothing's changing,
right.
You know, and nature doesn't do that. Nature doesn't stay the same. There's a constant growth. And even, you know, I look out in my garden and I have the same trees that were there last year, but they're different this year. Even at the same time of the year, there's a difference. There's something that's shifting all the time. And I don't think our culture really makes that a priority. You know? You're supposed to just get in a certain place and stay there because that's the ultimate way to be.
Yeah, really, if you think about everything we're talking about, it just comes back to being in tune with nature. You know, I just came back from Bali and have you ever been to Bali?
Mm-mm.
Oh, my God, the most spiritual place I've ever been. But mostly Indonesia is Muslim, but Bali is like 95% Hindu or something or other. And so someone said they're into animism, Hinduism and Buddhism. And so they believe every solid object has a spirit and honors it so. And they're just the most the way they live, it was awe-inspiring to see how these people live. And, we were in this yoga retreat thing, but the staff there, they're amazing staff. But you think, oh, they're amazing because they're getting paid to smile at us. The whole country's like that, you know, and the traffic and the scooters is just insane. But when they beep their horns, it's, I'm here, so don't hit me. It's not get out of the way.
And like there's just a totally,
even the honking of a horn has a different vibe than a honking of a horn in Australia or America. It's a, hey, don't bump into me. I'm here. It's not get out of the way. And it just, it's hard to believe that a horn sound, two that sound the same can have a different energy, but they do. Yeah. So,
but that's a nervous system thing again, right? Like if you're already regulated and feeling really safe in that culture and you were enjoying it and you were curious and you were feeling great, and then you hear the horn and you're like, your brain processes that as, oh, this is positive. Whereas in a culture where you're busy and it's chaos and it's all like there's so much going on, you hear the horn and it's just another pressure, it's another stress.
Yeah, or maybe it's the fact that my perception of what the horn meant changed, because when I first got there, first day, there's lots of horn honking and I'm thinking that people aren't kind of liking each other or whatever. But I took a ride around with a driver one day on a scooter, so I'm on the back of the scooter, so I'm really up close to people and seeing their faces and, you know, I'm not driving, so I'm looking around a lot. And I think I might have got it that day. It was like, when these people honk, it doesn't mean get out of the way. It's just I'm here. You know, yeah, but it was.
Do you have an awareness, Warwick, of what, like where or how did that shift happen in you? Like where was, like you said, when you landed, it wasn't there. Something happened where you got there. Does that make sense?
Well, I think it was riding around on the back of that, back of that scooter. And, you know, like say being around horses, you are always observing, looking for subtle clues to their mental state. And it's not like, oh, I need to look and see what this horse is doing in case he kicks me. It's not that. It's just, it's a way of being around horses that you're always reading that stuff.
It's language, and, isn't it?
Yeah. And so I think being on the back of that scooter and just looking around, I'm not just looking around, I'm looking at people's faces and reading their facial expressions and that sort of thing. And at some, yeah, at some point in time in that ride, it dawned on me, huh, that horn doesn't mean the same thing. And I think that's when maybe that's when the energy started feeling different. But I just left Bali having that energy about horns. So I forgot the fact that it was probably a transition at some point in time I made while I was there. But anyway, just amazing people and the way they live, and there's just an energy about them. I can't say enough about the Balinese people.
Yeah, that's definitely common. You hear that a lot when people come back, and just the temples and just feeling connected, right?
Yeah, we went to a temple. It was a big granite wall that they carved these temples into. It's probably maybe 10 meter high granite wall, you know, just would have been a wall of a cliff, and they've carved these temples into them and carved these rooms into them, meditation rooms and stuff in them.
Wow.
And standing in front of those big carved granite things, it's almost like you can feel the energy of everybody who's ever been there and prayed and worshipped there, you know. It's a very cool place.
Amazing.
Yeah, and I went there after the Gaucho Derby, so it was a perfect dovetail for me. I was ready for that, you know.
Yeah, that's what we'd call integration.
Yeah, it was great. It was perfect integration. And, you know, it was my 30th wedding anniversary, and so, you know, I'd had some revelations about my wife while I was away, so it was just a perfect integration for everything. Yeah. But enough of that about me. I want to get to your questions.
Sure.
And the first one you chose was, if you could spread a message across the world, one that people would listen to, what would it be?
Question everything. That's always my biggest motto. And I think alongside that is, you know, the Maya Angelou quote that says, do the best you can until you know better. And then when you know better, do better. So when you're questioning everything, you will find out quite quickly what else you need to know, and then you just keep doing better. And it, like we were saying about following that journey or following that energy, like we're never actually wrong. Nobody's wrong. Everyone's entitled to their point of view. Even if their points of view are shitty, they're still entitled to it. But if you are a conscious person, you'll be constantly changing that point of view as you move on your journey of life.
Well said. That was awesome.
So yeah, you just got to start with questioning.
Yeah, that's, you know, that's the thing, isn't it? Like, you got to realize there's no end, and it's just a series of steps, and everybody's where they're supposed to be, and so then there's no judgment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which is so hard. Like, no judgment is one of the hardest principles of life, I think, but it is, there's a reason it's a key teaching in most spiritual traditions, because when you can live without it, and I think a lot of time we think no judgment is some sort of thing only about not judging your experience or not judging people, but it's not judging all the things, including how other people are, because that's the way you become free. If you don't have judgment, then you're not holding on to anything and you can be free. And that's what my biggest interest is, how do people become free in a culture that isn't free?
All right. One of my former podcast guests, Christine Dixon, she was at our place here doing a retreat last year, and she was talking about, she said, you all have this bright, you were born with this bright shining light that you still have, but during life, silk scarves have been put one at a time over your light until there's so many scarves on there you can't see the light. You don't need more light. You just need to take the scarves off. And yep. I think while you were talking there, I was really thinking about, you know, because I had you listened to that podcast episode, I had an experience with some judgment, and when I let go of the judgment, there was nothing but love. And I think we are all love, and the only reason it doesn't shine is because of all the judgments. And if you don't have to love. I think we are love. You don't have to try to do that. You just got to get rid of the judgments.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. love that analogy with the scarves. I mean, that fits a lot of tradition, and, you know, there's goddess stories about that, of taking those layers of the scarves off and becoming, you know, kind of raw, like raw and vulnerable, and like what your true self is. And yeah, that's an invitation to everyone to just start stripping those scarves away.
Yeah, some of them are pretty sticky little bastards.
And sometimes they come back like a magnet.
Yeah. They got that static cling to them. Okay, next question was, what's the most worthwhile thing you have put your time into? Something that changed the course of your life? And we've had a conversation about like 15 or 20 of those things, so you pick.
Yeah, I was, when I, you know, I sent you those questions and then I went back to look at them and I thought, what did I choose that for? That's not an easy answer. But what I come to is the most worthwhile thing to do is to continue to trust myself and follow the energy.
Oh, okay. Sorry, I thought you were giving advice. I thought you were going to say, I thought you thought the question was for others. Yes, it's for you. Sorry to interrupt.
Yeah, the most worthwhile thing has been to continue to follow the energy and trust myself. Because every time I do that, like what we were saying, like every time I do that, I land in the right place, you know, with the connected, the less crunchy place. But anytime that I ignore that and maybe follow someone else's opinion or culture's opinion, or that's when it becomes a problem. So the most worthwhile thing is just to continue to keep coming back to myself, my center, my power, and work from there. That is all, and that can never fail, right? There's no failure in that. Even if it does become a little crunchy, I can look back 3 years later and go, oh, I see why that happened. Like, here I am now. Perfect.
That was perfectly crunchy.
Yeah.
Crunchy in the right kind of way. Type 2 fun, as we like to say. That's awesome. You know, that's been, not judging these answers, but that's been the furthest away from all the other answers to that question that I've got.
That's me.
Yeah, no, it's cool. It was cool. I loved it. I was digging that. That was a great way of putting it. Okay, in the past 5 years, what have you become better at saying no to?
Yeah, so saying no to that world out there that is not my world, that reality, that, you know, I don't even know what it's called because it's just not what the reality that I live in, but being able to, yeah, follow that energy, stay in my power, I guess say no to the expectations rather than the, yeah, saying no to the expectations is probably the best way to describe that. Yeah. And that's on everything. Like that's with the horsework, that's with my children, that's in my relationship, you know, it's all the things, the way we live. I mean, we live in a bus, you know, we don't live in a normal house with air conditioning and all those things. So just constantly, I'm almost addicted to saying no to the expectations of finding the next no, because that's another way to be free within reason.
Yeah. You know, once again, that is the furthest from the other group of answers to that question I've ever had, but that's so cool. Is normally people talk about certain situations, you know, they say no to, but you're basically saying no to the culture that's trying to run you, sort of thing. And that's a ballsy in the last 5 years. What do you become better at saying no to? That's like, that is a decision. It's a bit like, you know, say we use the ice baths a lot as an analogy or whatever, but getting into a pretty cold ice bath and making yourself get in there when 95% of your body's screaming to get out. It takes some discipline, and the way the world is these days, you know, for you to consciously choose to, I want to make these decisions, is there a part of you that would be like, I'd be so much easier if I wasn't doing this?
Yes and no. I think because of my wellness journey, I know that it works, you know, like I know that these things that are a little harder or a little less convenient, like I have kind of like a, in my brain, there's a hashtag that says authenticity over convenience, you know, like so many things are convenient, but they don't mean that they're real, and they're certainly not real for me. And because of what I had to do for my own health to do all those things that are less convenient, I know that. Like, I've got that embodied, so it's not so difficult anymore. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah.
But I do recognize that it's super hard for other people. Like, and it's, you know, sometimes you hear people talking about things like the ice bath, like, no, you just get in there and it's like, it's going to make everything better. And actually it doesn't for everyone because it can be too overwhelming. But, you know, recognizing that we all do the nose in different ways to get to that same place. Right. Like, yeah. Yeah, that's all I need to say about that. Do you have a question about that?
That's cool. You've given me a lot to think about, so I'm just going silent for a minute. I don't often go silent on these things, so congratulations. I'm going to close my eyes for a minute. You're not blowing my mind, but you this is all stuff I've heard before and talked about before, but you are like next level commitment. You know what I was going to say is, talking about this stuff, it's like people with who choose to do conscious parenting with their kids. Like, it was so much easier when you didn't have to pay attention. You could just tell them to shut up, stop making noise. You know what I mean? Like, bloody hell, that would be a whole lot easier.
Absolutely.
But it's the same with the horses. Like, these days, you know, I'm not limited, but I choose to limit the interactions I have with my horses because there's just some things that I don't wish to act like anymore. And it's more work. It's more planning. You got to be more thoughtful about, okay, I want to try to get this horse to, I've got to do this and how am I going to go about that? But the conscious parenting thing, oh my goodness, I can't imagine doing that these days.
Absolutely. Well, my kids are now in the launching phase, right? Like they're moving out of home and going to the next stage of their life and doing that conscious, like I was good at the infant conscious parenting and the attachment stuff. I was really good at that. But in this level, in the 20s, you know, teens and 20s, whole nother level, whole other world. Just got to keep questioning.
Yes. Very much keep questioning. Speaking of children, the next question you chose was, what did you want to be as a child?
Oh, yeah, well, I wanted to be a horse girl, which I didn't have any access to as a kid. And then I wanted to be a rider and a teacher, which is kind of what's happened. Like, I write lots of course material, I teach. You know, I certainly didn't see the therapy part coming, but the other stuff are all kind of spot on. And I also, there was a phase where I contemplated being a professional fighter and going down that realm or going down the, like stunt people, you know, like using the martial arts from that stunt capacity, because there's a few women I knew when I was growing up that were into that. And the only things that stopped me from doing those things was the expectations of culture, the fears that I'm not good enough, like all that sort of stuff. And I see that as a pretty regular, that's the thing that's always got in the way, you know. So outside of the martial arts stuff, I'm pretty much doing everything I wanted to do. And then I've got a martial arts school anyway, so I'm kind of doing that too. I just never went on a movie to do fancy shit, which I don't think I would enjoy.
Yeah, you'd have to be out amongst people.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay, and the last question that you chose was, what's your definition of leader and follower? What does it mean to be a leader and a follower to you?
I haven't really thought about the answer to this question, but I've spoken a lot about it over the years. There's something around when you lead well, you give permission to others to do so, or to lead themselves. So I run a really large conference and I, you know, have staff and there's all these parts where I'm just thinking like the only thing I can do as a good leader in those places is be the mentor or the – not even the mentor, be the person that I am so that gives them permission to be the people they are. And I think that's where leadership really comes from. And even when I work with the horses, it's like, I'm just thinking yesterday, like we were down by the creek and my really naughty young Brumby had broken out of the fence again. And I was saying to her, all right, well, come on, let's go. And it was this conversation in my head, a conversation about you're going to follow me because I'm going to show you exactly how we do it here. Like I'm just going to do me and I'm going to become, and I'm just going to walk and you're going to follow me. And it bloody worked. But then this morning she did it again. And this time I followed her and she did the behavior that I'd done yesterday. And I just followed her up to where I wanted her to be. So there's also something in leading and following where all of us get to be both. You know, I get to learn from my staff. I am not always the person who's doing all the showing. I get to learn from other people. And if we all just be authentic in ourselves, then that's a really nice harmonious flow. You know, I take a lot of my thoughts around leadership and followership from Elsa Sinclair's work around harmony. You know, there's always someone leading and following. Yeah. We want to lead and follow, but we also just really want to be in harmony. So that's actually the focus. The focus is not being the leader. The focus is harmony. And then the leading and following will just come about naturally in the space in the way that it needs to be.
Very well said. That right there. I loved that. That was a great speech. In the middle of that, you were saying something about, you know, I organize conferences and that sort of thing. Tell us about exactly what you're doing as far as how can people see you, hear about you, see you in, you know, at a conference, or tell me all about those things.
Sure. So my everyday work is the psychotherapy, and that's full. Like, I don't take new clients at the moment, but sometimes I do. So, you know, follow me on socials if that's what you want to do. But in terms of more educational work, I run regular retreats here that are all about being in nature. And by here, I mean I'm on Walbunja Yuin land just outside of Canberra and near the south coast in Australia. And so that's a good way to work with me and my crazy horses. Also, I run this conference called Wise Women Gathering that happens in May, 90 minutes from Sydney. And that's a conference that focuses on four streams. We look at herbal wisdom or herbal medicine. We look at holistic living, women's mysteries, and creating community. And that's an annual event where we have like 35 different educators from Australia all focused on those streams. And it's just this beautiful 4-day community of women and their children. They can bring their children. We have a kids camp. And yeah, that's a very special time of the year. And every year I think, okay, I'm not doing that again. It's so big. But then I get there and it's so wonderful. And then I commit to another year. So we are headed to another year right now, coming into the May conference. But it's kind of different from my other work in a way. And I always teach there as well. But there's plenty of other educators, and it's a really beautiful way. If people are sort of hearing me and going, oh yeah, what she's doing is interesting, but I don't know if I'm ready to go deep on the retreat stuff, it's a nice way to come into community and meet people, because it really is a community that's ongoing. And then of course I run online circles and face-to-face circles and things, but everything I do is for women. So if you're a man, I hope that there's things you can access that don't involve me.
Hey, I'm a man. I've been fascinated the whole time. You said if you're interested, you follow me on social media. You're supposed to tell us right there what that social media name is.
Right. That's Holly.Wilderthorn. And Wilderthorn is spelled like wild and then with an E and then thorn. Oh, and my Holly is an IE, not a Y. My website is the Institute for Self-Crafting, and that's where people can find out all of the retreats and things. And then if you're interested in Wise Women Gathering, that's wisewomengathering.com. That's that larger conference.
That sounds amazing. So we've had, the last 2 years, we've had a Journey on Podcast Summit where we've had 20-something of the previous years guests come and present over 3 days, and then people who've heard them on the podcast get to come, hear them, get to meet them, mingle with them, chat with them, and the energy there has been like insane. So I've felt what you're talking about, how you said, you know, it's a lot of work, but wow, it's pretty cool to be a part of.
So worth it. And it just, every year when I question myself about it, it's like, does it come back to my primary interest, which is empowering people to live more closely connected to each other and nature? Like, yes, absolutely it does. So just keep doing it.
Yeah, checks all the boxes.
Yeah.
Super cool. Well, thank you so much for joining me. I had such a fun conversation with you. I could talk to you for hours, but we have to.
I've really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much. And thanks for us finding a time that worked for both of us. I don't know if people realize that Australia is a day, I'm a day ahead of you. Like, you haven't even happened yet in our world.
You're in the future. You know, it's funny. Australia is normally 5 hours or 7 hours different from the United States, a day ahead, but 5 or 7 hours behind. And so when Holly and I set up this thing, I set it up for the time in America that it was going to be in Australia, you know, so we'd be on the same time. But last night, America changed out of daylight savings, but Australia didn't. So it ended up being an hour off. I was an hour early, but that's all right. The perils of trying to talk to people all over the world. Okay, well, Holly,
thank
you so much.
That's the worst thing that happened to us. It's okay.
Yeah, I think we'll be good. I think we'll be perfect. So thank you so much. If you guys at home, thanks for listening, and we'll join you on the next episode of the Journey On Podcast.
Thanks for being a part of the Journey On Podcast with Warwick Schiller. Warwick has over 850 full-length training videos on his online video library at videos.warwickschiller.com. Be sure to follow Warwick on YouTube, Facebook, and Instagram to see his latest training advice and insights.